KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. Aisha Roscoe, good morning. Daylight saving time started today. You lost an hour of sleep, but we're here to wake you up. President Trump is all in on cryptocurrency and calling for a federal crypto reserve. What would that mean for the U.S.?
The crypto industry is basically a giant offshore casino. And the U.S. government has never been in the business of speculating on financial assets.
5 years after the start of the pandemic, we hear personal reflections on the crisis. It's Sunday, March 9th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. House Republicans are attempting another stopgap extension to avoid a partial government shutdown this week. They released a bill yesterday that would pay for the government through September 30th. NPR's Tamara Keith has more.
It basically punts the big decisions, the deep cuts that conservatives want, until later this year. It keeps the top line budget number the same as the last fiscal year, but shifts around some funding. It increases defense spending and decreases non-defense spending. It boosts funding for immigration enforcement, but doesn't include additional disaster assistance for the California wildfires or the hurricanes last year. In short, it's meant to keep congressional Republicans content and buy time for them to work on what President Trump really wants, which is big tax cuts and a significant boost in immigration spending.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. The Secret Service says a man brandishing a firearm in Washington, D.C. was shot by Secret Service officers near the White House this morning. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
By mid-morning, in the shadow of the Eisenhower Executive Office building near the White House, only remnants of yellow police tape remained. Around midnight, Secret Service officers saw a man who looked like someone local police had warned them about, described as a suicidal individual, possibly on his way from Indiana. Officers went up to him and saw he had a gun. The Secret Service says officers shot the man just steps away from the White House grounds. He was taken to a hospital. His condition is unknown. President Trump was at his home in Mar-a-Lago, Florida, during the shooting. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Canada's ruling Liberal Party is selecting a new leader today to replace Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He announced earlier this year that he's stepping down after serving a decade as the country's leader. As NPR's Jackie Northam reports, the new prime minister will have to focus on Canada's economic challenges and President Trump's tariffs.
There are four candidates vying to replace Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. The frontrunner is Mark Carney. The 59-year-old comes from the world of finance, including stints as head of both the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England. That expertise could be critical to tackle Canada's economy. But Carney says he will also be tough with President Trump and his seemingly chaotic trade policies. Trump has helped energize the Liberal Party's leadership contest. His taunts about turning Canada into a 51st state have sparked a wave of nationalism. They have also helped burnish Trudeau's legacy. 2 months ago, he was deeply unpopular. Now he's seen as standing up to Trump. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
The State Department says Secretary of State Marco Rubio will travel to Saudi Arabia this week for talks on ending Russia's war in Ukraine. He's to meet with his Ukrainian counterparts there tomorrow and Tuesday. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. France says it will send Ukraine an additional $200 million in military aid to help Ukraine fight Russian forces. Officials say the money will come from interest on Russian assets frozen by France. France and other European countries are trying to compensate for cuts in assistance by the U.S. The mayor of San Jose is offering a plan to help people who are experiencing homelessness. Unhoused people will be offered shelter 3 times before being arrested. Elise Manoukian of member station KQED reports.
San Jose resident Jacqueline Eden says she hopes the effort to reduce homelessness will be productive.
They're not just telling them, hey, we're going to arrest you. They're giving them 3 chances to, maybe the first time they don't accept it, do they say, okay, well, just think about it.
Mayor Matt Mahan's plan would make San Jose the latest California city to attempt to reduce unsheltered homelessness. The move comes after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled last year to allow arrests of people who are sleeping in public. Critics of Mahan's plan point to a report from February that shows most city shelter beds are already full. They say the mayor's proposal won't help unhoused people get what they need, permanent, stable housing. For NPR News, I'm Elise Manoukian.
Civil rights activists will march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama this afternoon. It was 60 years ago that hundreds of civil rights advocates marched to demand their constitutional right to vote. They were beaten by Alabama state troopers, an event that became known as Bloody Sunday and helped galvanize the civil rights movement. The Federal Voting Rights Act passed later that year. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Many countries have strategic reserves in case of shortages or as a way to keep prices stable. The U.S. has its strategic oil reserves. China has tens of thousands of tons of frozen raw pork. The newest reserve? Bitcoin. Last week, President Trump signed an order to create a strategic reserve of cryptocurrency. To explain how this might work, we called up Zeke Fox. He's an investigative reporter with Bloomberg and author of the book Number Go Up about the crypto industry. He joins us now. Good morning.
Morning.
Typically, these strategic reserves are commodities. Oil, grain, pork, but cryptocurrencies exist in ledgers on computers. So how will a digital currency reserve work?
What the administration officials have said the plan is that the U.S. already digitally holds quite a lot of Bitcoin. There's a lot of crime involving Bitcoin, and it often results in the Bitcoins being seized by the U.S. government. And in the past, these have been auctioned off by the U.S. Marshals Service for regular U.S. dollars, which can be used for whatever. Now, the government is going to hold on to these Bitcoins. The purpose of that is not entirely clear, but Donald Trump has hinted if the price goes up a lot, this could help pay off the national debt.
How much would the amount of Bitcoin they have now, how much is that in like U.S. dollars at this point?
It's about $20 billion. And even if you believe that the U.S. government should be gambling on the price of Bitcoin, this is not nearly enough to have an impact on anything.
And what is the argument that this would be helpful?
The crypto industry is really good at creating this impression that this is the future and that the U.S. government needs to get on this or we'll be left behind. I've spent years traveling the world investigating this industry, and what I've found is there's nothing there. Crypto's been around for 15 years. It's as old as Uber. It's as old as WhatsApp, but pretty much no one is using it for anything but financial speculation. The crypto industry is basically a giant offshore casino. Even if you believe that these are winning bets, the U.S. government has never been in the business of speculating on financial assets.
Just a few years ago, Trump called cryptocurrency a scam. So what changed?
During his most recent campaign, a few dozen of the richest Bitcoiners got together and they engaged in this concerted lobbying effort to change his mind. And last July, they held a fundraiser that reportedly raised $25 million for Trump. And after that, Trump went on stage at this Bitcoin conference and promised them he would deregulate the crypto industry. He'd make the U.S. the crypto capital of the planet. And that's where he first floated this strategic reserve plan, which has been a pipe dream of Bitcoin advocates for years.
President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump, they both have their own coins. The family has its own crypto business called World Liberty Financial. Is that a conflict of interest?
Yeah, when you've got the U.S. government spending its money on these assets, and you've got people who are in the administration investing in the assets, yeah, it's a clear conflict of interest.
The Securities and Exchange Commission had been investigating the crypto industry, but under Trump, those investigations ended. What were they focused on?
The SEC under the Biden administration, they're basically saying that some of these cryptocurrencies count as securities, meaning things that we regulate, and that the industry had not been following the long-established rules around securities, which mandate that you have to file these detailed disclosures. There's rules around trading. Industry has said cryptocurrencies are different. We need new rules. And right now, the Trump administration has said they agree with that position, and they're in the process of working out these new rules, whatever they're going to be.
That's Zeke Fox. He's an investigative reporter with Bloomberg, and his book about cryptocurrency is called Number Go Up. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been 5 years since COVID-19 became a global pandemic. Our lives changed drastically, almost overnight.
You try to wear gloves, I guess, and wash your hands. If you got hand sanitizers, you can use that. But
yeah. When I first walked into campus after my spring break, it was honestly, it felt like a different city. It's very empty.
It's very hurting, not able to support my family due to me losing my job and losing everything. We've sold and pawned everything that we've had, and we don't have anything now.
Back in 2020, as social distancing became a strange new practice, with schools and many workplaces closed, and the future so uncertain as the coronavirus spread, we asked people around the country to share their experiences with us. Today, we're checking back in with a few folks about how that time has stayed with them.
It's like a period of time that came and went, and there were so many lives lost.
Tedris Pope's mother was among the first people to die in the U.S. from COVID. She was a nurse who worked at a hospital in Boston.
The loss of a parent is never going to be anything that you will forget. We weren't able to be with her for her last breath. The physical things that brings you closure, we were denied. Holidays have always been hard. They continue to be hard. She's definitely missed, especially when it's her siblings that come together. You always get a chance to see, you know, who is not there. You know, she missed the birth of her last grandchild. She wasn't here for that. The master's degree that were earned by two of her grandchildren, she made it a point to be at every graduation, and she missed. You know what I mean? She has a couple of grandchildren that are coming out of high school, and she won't be here for those. So we think about that and how she's going to miss all of these moments that were really important to her, especially when it was surrounded by education.
To honor her mom, Tedris Pope's family started a scholarship in her name, and they hope to gather again this year to celebrate her life.
There's an element of grace that came with the pandemic, and it was quite liberating for me in many ways.
James Ainsworth is a journalist and copywriter. He uses a wheelchair because he's paralyzed from the waist down. Before the pandemic, getting around his hometown of Denver had been challenging and at times isolating. But as so many activities moved online in 2020, he could suddenly participate in church and classes and in community events with ease. James Ainsworth is happy to report it stayed that way.
People forget that there are a lot of people who have limited mobility, limited options for travel, entertainment, etc. And so I think having the option to participate in a community online has really meant the world to me. It's opened doors and it's deepened the relationships with people and the groups that I have as a part of my life.
My name is Sharos Charania. I am 25 years old.
And she started March of 2020 as a junior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But when campus closed, she lost her student job and ended up back in Chicago, living in a small three-bedroom house with her parents and sister.
I didn't even have space to really sit down and do work. I used to sit like in a corner. My parents needed to make a living, working in places like the airport and hotels where there's a lot of people. So they were more susceptible to getting COVID than I was. And I always felt guilty for that. I can't help but say, but I did almost lose my parents. They actually ended up getting COVID. Both of my parents actually are diabetic. There were a lot of feelings of being frustrated, being upset, you know, I think even borderline being angry, which what I was dealing with having sick parents and then also trying to finish school. But I realized that there is a disparity that exists for folks who have to live this life of catching maybe disproportionately illnesses or diseases. It was a very scary but eye-opening experience and really paved the path for me of like who I want to be in the future. I actually work at Kaiser Permanente, making the experiences of our members and our patients much better. And my story of growing up as a first-generation college student, it's been a very full-circle moment where I am overseeing teams, working on different projects, and working with senior leadership team around making care better. The pandemic, you know, has taught me that it's so important to have, you know, a community and family and really valuing those relationships. You know, my parents are still working those same jobs. I eventually want to be in a stage financially in my career where I can support my parents to the fullest, where they can retire. I know I will eventually get there. It's just some time until that point.
That's Sharos Charania. We also heard from James Ainsworth and Tedris Pope reflecting on life 5 years after the start of the pandemic. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Congress has until Friday to avoid a partial government shutdown. House Republicans have a proposal that would continue paying for government programs through the end of September. It would slightly boost defense spending while cutting non-defense programs. Canada's Liberal Party selected its new leader today who will succeed Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Trudeau has announced he's stepping down after more than 9 years in power. And thousands of people demonstrated in Nepal today, calling for the South Asian nation to return to a monarchy. The last king gave up his throne in 2006 in response to street protests. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. President Donald Trump has asked Congress to act on one of his top domestic priorities.
And the next phase of our plan to deliver the greatest economy in history is for this Congress to pass tax cuts for everybody. They're in there. They're waiting for you to vote.
Cutting taxes was also a priority during Trump's first term. His 2017 overhaul of the tax code slashed corporate taxes. It also cut taxes on small businesses and individual taxpayers. But those cuts expire this year. Now, as Republicans in Congress move to extend them and add even more cuts, we wanted to look at the 2017 tax changes and what effects they had. Elena Patel is a professor at the University of Utah's Eccles School of Business. She's also a fellow at the nonpartisan Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the 2017 tax cuts for corporations. Taxes on their profits were slashed from 35% to 21%. And President Trump promised this would be, quote, rocket fuel for the economy by incentivizing corporate investment. Did that happen?
I think it's a question we may unfortunately never know the answer to just because of the pandemic. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act became law at the beginning of 2018. And just 2 years later, the pandemic arrived. And the pandemic fundamentally altered investment in the U.S. in a way that's really hard for us to separate from anything that might have come from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And there is some evidence that there were small increases in investment, but there's no evidence that aggregate investment increased. Instead, what we think happened is that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act just changed which firms were investing, maybe without actually affecting overall investment.
Now on to small businesses. Their tax bill was cut in half from 40 to 20%. I mean, small business owners must have benefited from that, right?
We definitely know that small business owners got a tax cut, but we also know that that tax cut was not evenly spread out throughout the economy. It's definitely the wealthiest of the wealthy that benefited from that tax cut, and it was not accompanied by things we might have hoped for, like increased employment or an increase in wages.
And what about individual taxpayers? How big were their tax cuts and who benefited the most from those?
So estimates of the change in the tax bill for individuals certainly shows that everybody has lower taxes right now. But again, the benefit of the cut in individual tax rates is felt the highest at the top of the income distribution. And so at the top of the income distribution, there are estimates that suggest that tax savings were as much as $250,000 compared to just $70 for the lowest quintile.
And is the big thing for regular people with the standard deduction, was that the biggest change because they doubled the standard deduction?
It's a combination of lower tax rates, although they only fell by a couple percentage points in each bracket, but also the standard deduction. And I would just take a second to applaud that change. That's a change that makes the tax code simpler for everybody. Fewer people have to itemize. It's easier to do your tax return. So I think everybody thinks that increasing the standard deduction is generally a good change to the tax code.
A big promise that was made to individuals was that the businesses would have a lot more money left over that they would use to reward their employees with higher wages. So basically it's like, yes, the businesses would get a big tax cut, but that would help you as an employee because you would get higher wages. Did that come true?
No, there's absolutely no evidence that shows that anybody below top management received any higher wages as a result of the tax cuts.
The first Trump administration promised these changes would not grow the budget deficit. How did that work out?
So I think we estimated that the tax cut in 2017 would reduce revenue by $1.5 trillion. That was the official estimate. Definitely lots of groups tried to account for things that are called dynamic effects, changes to the size of the economy, employment, investment, all of these sort of economy growing ingredients, and how much that might reduce the cost of the bill. And the largest estimate out there is that it might have offset the cost by about 30%. There's no estimate out there that suggests that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act paid for itself.
In his address to the nation last week, President Trump promised to balance the budget. If the tax cuts go through, and it does appear they will, is that mathematically possible?
There's no world in which that's mathematically possible. Lots of people have tried to do this calculation to understand the projection that the House GOP is making, that there'll be nearly $3 trillion in new growth under the TCJA extension.
And when you say TCJA, you mean the 2017 tax cuts?
That's exactly right. And that would require something like a 75% sustained increase in real economic growth, which is just completely implausible. And I think that most people will back that up. Again, a lot of groups have tried to estimate, if we extend the TCJA, what kind of growth can we expect? And the highest end of this for $5 trillion is in spending is $710 billion in new revenue. So that's far short of $2.6 trillion, which is what's being assumed right now by the House GOP.
That's Elena Patel, professor at the University of Utah and fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
An NPR investigation has uncovered problems with the way the federal judiciary polices complaints about abuse and harassment. Justice correspondent Kerry Johnson spent nearly a year talking to people in and outside the courts, and she found a widespread culture of fear about reporting judges who behave badly. Kerry joins us now to talk about her reporting. Hi, Kerry.
Hi there.
So what got you started on this project?
I've been really interested in power and accountability, and federal judges have a lot of power. They serve for life. They often hire clerks just out of law school to help them in chambers. But the judge is really in charge of what happens inside his or her chambers. And when those judges are bullies or harassers, that can really mean terrible things for the young law clerks.
So you spoke to 42 people? What stands out from what they told you?
These are all current or former employees of the federal courts. They told me about bad experiences they had working for more than 24 judges. Those judges are men and women, Democrats and Republicans, older and younger. And by far the most common complaint I heard was about abusive or hostile behavior, bullying. But these are situations that went way beyond a few harsh words and into yelling and even, in a few cases, fear that a judge might hit a law clerk or throw something at them.
Is there something of a culture of secrecy inside federal courthouses?
Yeah, clerks and other employees are warned about protecting confidential information. They're really not supposed to talk about cases or how judges reach their decisions. And they're not supposed to talk about anything else that happens behind closed doors there. They get warnings in the beginning of their jobs and in the middle of their jobs, too. That said, a small number of former clerks decided to speak with me about their experience. One of them clerked years ago for a federal judge in Puerto Rico. She was afraid to talk on tape, so we got a voice actor to say her words verbatim.
There was a moment when he was traveling, and I think he was traveling in Boston, and he came back. He gave me a huge hug. And I remember that when we pulled away from the hug, he tried to kiss me on the lips. And again, I was just shocked.
That clerk says she tried to report the judge, Jose Antonio Fuste, but nothing ever happened until 2016 when he retired with full benefits after another clerk reported him. I tried to reach the judge for comment, but he did not respond to phone calls or an email or to messages that I sent to his relatives.
Kerry, what are the courts saying about your investigation?
Well, first of all, it's important to know the federal courts are kind of a patchwork. So each court system around the country has its own rules and systems and processes. But the administrative office of the courts here in D.C. handles all kinds of policy and administration. A spokesperson there told me they've put in place a lot of changes since the Me Too movement 7 years ago. They say those changes have had a really positive impact. And three of the judges in my story have all left the bench. They say they're continuing to make improvements for workers. But I've heard from many new people in the past week since our investigation aired, reporting concerns and wrongdoing, and I'll be following up on their struggles this year.
NPR Justice Correspondent Kerry Johnson, we will be listening for more. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
One of China's best-known contemporary poets is a middle-aged woman from the countryside who is loved by millions for her unpretentious and suggestive verse. Some call her China's Emily Dickinson, although she chafes at that notion. But she has pushed artistic boundaries her whole life. Now she's taking it to a new level, as NPR's John Ruich reports.
We meet Yu Xiuhua in a dressing room backstage at a community theater in Shanghai. She's in sweatpants and her hair's a mess. She's not here for a poetry reading. She's here to dance. And that might surprise people who know about her. Yu, who's 48, has cerebral palsy. It affects not only the way she talks, but her movement. Her gait is stiff and slow. And she says she does not qualify as a dancer.
Someone who dances isn't necessarily a dancer, just like someone who writes poetry isn't necessarily a poet, and a man isn't necessarily a man.
But soon she's up on stage. 10,000 Tons of Moonlight is a dance theater production inspired by Yu's poetry. It reflects on love, beauty, disability, and the societal expectations placed on women. In it, Yu performs simple dance moves, waving her arms, crouching down low, swaying and twirling alongside two live professional dancers. She recites poems, and an actress narrates portions in English. The stage is a very long way from Yu's roots in a farming village in central China. But Yu has been catapulted to unlikely national fame by poems like perhaps her best-known one, entitled I Traveled Across Half of China to Sleep with You. Her openness about love and sexual desire bucks norms for women in China, and is all the more liberating because she hails from a farm. Yu says, as far as she's concerned, there's no deep message in her artwork.
I am Yu Xiuhua, nothing more. I'm not trying to use anything to tell others what I am. Poetry or dance, they simply prove my existence as Yu Xiuhua, not as a poet or a dancer.
But her very existence and fame is in some ways extraordinary, in a place where people with disabilities are often marginalized or hidden. British dance producer Farooq Chaudhry is the show's director. He stumbled upon Yu's life story a few years ago.
This is an incredible story of a woman who, in many ways, defies many of the societal rules. Right, and is loved by many, particularly young women. You know, she's almost a feminist in some ways, and so she's, and not that she's necessarily driving a cult movement of any kind, but just by being honest and true to herself, she's empowering other people.
That potentially skirts close to a red line in China. The authorities have targeted feminist organizations and snuffed out a nascent Me Too movement by jailing activists. Yu says activism has never been her goal. She's inspired by love, she says. The poem, I Traveled Halfway Across China to Sleep with You, for instance, is just an expression of feelings.
As for any deeper interpretations, these are others' understandings and have nothing to do with me. I was simply writing down my thoughts from that particular moment. Nothing more, nothing else.
Artists, she says, are responsible for the creation and transmission of beauty.
I've never thought about expressing anything. When no one knew me before, when there was no such thing as fame, I wrote a lot of poems, all for my own enjoyment, never to please others or to express something.
So I asked her, what if nobody came to see the show or read her poems? Would she be okay with that? It would not make a difference, she tells me, adding that my question is weird. She says she can't lose her job because writing poetry is a form of self-expression of the soul. It doesn't depend on an audience. The evening that I caught a rehearsal of her show, though, the audience seemed to enjoy it thoroughly. John Ruich, NPR News, Shanghai.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Hundreds of dairy farmers around the country feel some relief this weekend after federal funds they had been awarded were unfrozen and payments are being promised. But there's still worry in rural communities that were part of President Trump's win, especially in critical states like Wisconsin, the dairy state. Chuck Quernbach of member station WUWM reports.
President Trump's election victory over Democrat Kamala Harris in Wisconsin was by less than 1% of the statewide tally. But in the town of Freedom, southwest of Green Bay, the president picked up 70% of the community's 4,000 votes. Freedom is where Tammy Fritch owns what she and her daughter call Two Guernsey Girls Creamery. It's licensed as a micro dairy, only 13 cows and just a few employees. Fritch stands over a stainless steel vat about the size of a large bathtub and removes a plastic sheet covering blocks of white cheddar cheese. She takes a knife and starts a process called flipping the cheese. At the end, it'll be a cubed, often squeaky-to-eat snack called curds.
So we are making cheese curds today, so I have approximately 72 pounds of cheese in there.
Fritch says using the milk from her Guernsey cows, which is easier for some people to digest, she now wants to make and sell ice cream. Last year, she won just under $100,000 through a dairy business innovation grant. DBI, as it's known, was created under the Farm Bill Trump signed in 2018 during his first term. Like the grant requires, Fritch invested in her farm first. She bought equipment, taking out a bank loan to afford it. She started hiring a couple employees. Then, late last month, Fritch got the word that the U.S. Department of Agriculture halted the funding.
Plain and simple. I mean, these are not tax dollars that are wasted. We are growing to help our community. We're producing a great product here.
Friday, the USDA reversed course and okayed the DBI reimbursements. As much as $28.6 million will pay back 420 dairy processors and farmers across the nation. Wisconsin Republican House member Derek Van Orden says he commends Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins for, quote, her swift action to ensure DBI's continuation. Rebecca Sweeney of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association says many grant recipients were on edge.
The last 2 weeks have been filled with tears and fear. The amount of stress that some of these farmers and processors have been under, knowing that funding was paused, was significant.
In tiny Vernon County, Wisconsin, which Trump won by 8 percentage points in November, it appears farmer Travis Forgs will receive the $92,000 DBI funding he was promised. He's already purchased a very large freezer to temporarily store some of the cheese he makes from the milk of about 300 sheep. But the Trump administration is still frozen about $55,000 Forgs says he was expecting to pay for solar panels under a federal program to boost renewable energy in rural areas.
We have the contract signed. Did I think that perhaps in the future these grants wouldn't be available? Absolutely, because that happens with different leaders in place. But did I in the wildest dreams think that they wouldn't honor their word as our federal government? Absolutely not.
Other Wisconsin farmers say they worry about additional funding freezes, tariffs against the U.S., or possible cuts in nutrition programs that provide farm income. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
This is NPR News.
All 50 states report a reduction in deaths from illicit drugs.
We are on track to return to levels of overdose before fentanyl emerged.
That decline in deaths leaves the question of how to treat and care for the many drug users who are living. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Secretary of State Marco Rubio heads to Saudi Arabia tomorrow, where he's to meet with his counterparts from Ukraine. They're to discuss ways to end Russia's war in Ukraine. French officials say they're providing Ukraine with another $200 million in military aid as it battles Russian forces. France is among the European nations trying to make up for a pause in military aid from the U.S. And the Secret Service says officers shot a man this morning who was brandishing a firearm near the White House. He was hospitalized. President Trump was at his home in Florida at the time. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Florence Grimes is a hot mess. She's shopping and about to shoplift a pricey outfit she thinks she needs when, ping, 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 her phone gets a rapid series of messages.
Emergency at school. Get here quick. My eyes dart across the screen, trying to make sense of what's happening. Police are on their way. A warm, woozy feeling washes over me. What's going on? I type. No one replies. There's a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. I try again. What is going on? But the other mothers just ignore me. The group chat goes silent. I throw my sweatshirt on top of the bodysuit and barge out of the dressing room, racing towards the escalator. My heart hammers in my chest as I pound out a text to Dylan on my phone. Are you okay? Text me back, I command, right away. I wipe the sweat from my forehead and stare at my phone, willing my son to reply. Last seen 4 hours ago, his profile taunts me.
There's been a kidnapping at her 10-year-old son's London prep school, and over the next 300 pages or so, Florence will make a series of questionable choices in order to make sure he's safe. All the Other Mothers Hate Me is Sarah Harmon's first novel, and she joins us now from the BBC. Welcome.
Hi, Aisha. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Why do all the other mothers hate Florence?
I think Florence is somewhat of an unlikable protagonist, right? She's not like the other mothers at this ritzy London prep school that her child attends. For starters, she's a washed-up girl band singer. She's a decade younger than the other mothers. She doesn't really have a job. She's getting by making balloon arrangements that she sells to the rich moms of Holland Park. It's like that thing, Aisha, that people say about child stars or people who get famous really young. She sort of had an arrested development at the moment that she tasted fame, and she's been about 19 in her mind ever since, even though she's now 31 when the story kicks off. And she gets up to a series of hijinks, which you perfectly alluded to, once her son becomes a suspect in his classmate's mysterious disappearance.
I was thinking about the other modern British literary hot messes, Rebecca Bloomwood in Confessions of a Shopaholic, Bridget Jones. How do you think Florence fits into that canon?
As an author, I'm flattered to have her mentioned in the same sentence as any of those characters. I think Florence herself would think that she's a lot edgier and cooler than those women because she's kind of got a chip on her shoulder, at least at the beginning of the book. That said, I don't think that Florence has ever read a book in her life. So aside from watching the Bridget Jones movie, I'm not sure how many of them she would actually know.
You're an American living in the UK. In this book, Florence is an American living in the UK. Because she's American, and for all the other reasons we've outlined, she's a bit of an outsider. Like, did you feel any connection to looking at British culture from the outside? Is that part of what you brought to the book?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt like it was really interesting to have this outsider's perspective on this really rarefied slice of society. The school that her son attends is an expensive private day school in London that's paid for by her ex-husband. Florence could never afford this school. It's such a class-obsessed society. And sometimes I feel like being an American here, you're like a neutral observer. Like you're not really part of the class system. I moved here as an adult. Like it's too late for me to get a British accent. So I'm just sort of on the outside looking in. And I tried to bring some of those observations to Florence, who also is American in the book and is looking at this society that she's never really going to fit in and be a part of. I think the difference is Florence is completely uninterested in fitting in. She's happy being an outsider, whereas I tried very hard to make friends with the other moms and not do some of the naughty things that Florence gets up to.
She's a lot of things, Florence, but she loves her son, Dylan. Tell us about Dylan, though, because Dylan's a little bit different. He's a little quirky.
Dylan's a little quirky, but come on, wouldn't you be if you were raised by Florence? Like, what? He didn't have much of a chance. He's 10 years old. He's a real do-gooder type. He has, I would say, a good heart because of the way other people perceive him. He gets bullied at school, but he's a good kid.
Just very into, like, the environment, very protective of animals. And that's what kind of gets him into it with the school bully, Alfie. Tell us about that mystery at the center of the book, because Alfie goes missing.
You know, I was really intrigued by the idea of these missing kids stories. There's a lot of books and a lot of media and stories about missing kids, fact and fiction. It's clearly something as a culture that really gets under our skin. And I wanted to see if it was possible to kind of have a more lighthearted take on a missing kid story. And I know that might sound sacrilegious because obviously it can be a difficult topic, but
it's not heavy drama. It's
not heavy drama, right? Yes. Like it's the lightest possible version, I think, of this story. Look, I was a news reporter for like 15 years. There's a lot of darkness in the world. When I started writing this book, I was like, I want the happy ending that we never get.
But it's very twisty and turny. Like she goes there with some of these decisions.
She really does. And I thought it was important for her as a character, because one of the things that I was interested in was like, we see a lot of depictions in media of like the hard-boiled male detective, and you know, he's on the case, but he's really detached. He doesn't have any like feelings about it. And that's part of what makes him cool. It's like he's looking at all this hard stuff and it doesn't touch him. And Florence is the opposite. She's incredibly invested, overly invested, way beyond what would be appropriate or ethical. And I thought it was interesting to think about, look, even if you're not a parent, you don't have to be a parent to appreciate this, but what would you not do for your absolute favorite person in the world if you really thought they were in trouble? Is there something that you would say, no, that's just a bridge too far? We all have someone that we just are not rational about and that we would go there for. And for Florence, that's her son, Dylan, and she does go there.
That's Sarah Harmon. Her debut novel is All the Other Mothers Hate Me. Thank you so much for joining us.
Ayesha, it was so fun. Thanks for talking with me.
Do you ever find yourself channeling the power of a movie music moment? Maybe you've got a great big challenge and you really need that inner Thor. Maybe you just need something to pull you out of a funk, like in Almost Famous. Hold me closer, tiny dancer. Later today on All Things Considered with Scott Detrow, movie music, when the right tune mixes with the right moment. Tune in on your phone, your smart speaker, or on your radio. Rungano Nyoni was grieving. Her grandmother had died, and her great uncle had issued an edict that the funeral not feature the wailing and singing and house visits of typical Zambian mourning. Instead, Nyoni's ancestral village was quiet. And in the stillness, the British filmmaker had such a vivid dream that she wrote it down.
I don't know why I was writing it out. I was sort of no longer in a very great mental state. And I just started writing it out. And a couple of hours later, the sun comes up and I'd written out, what is this film?
The film is called On Becoming a Guinea Fowl. It starts with the death of a character known as Uncle Fred, his body found on an empty road late at night.
Just look at the situation. My Uncle Fred, uksanga dead body, I won't pay pin up a brothel.
Shula, Uncle Fred's niece, is immediately drawn into the traditions that writer and director Nyoni so missed. But Uncle Fred was a serial sexual assailant. Shula herself is a survivor of sexual assault, and underneath all the crying and careful choreography of full Zambian mourning is a silent unease. Susan Shardy plays Shula in her feature film debut, and she says it was a challenge to play this reluctant mourner.
The challenge of it was kind of trying to find this voice and trying to find the ability to be heard when you're not speaking. So it was quite... She's a complex, kind of layered character who internalizes everything, and I myself do not internalize everything. So that was the challenge and the beauty of getting to inhabit this space of quiet observation and deep introspection.
This is a movie about a family in Zambia, but this is a universal story, right? And there's often a question of, what do you do? The person did some horrible things. This family member did some horrible things, but now they're dead. Do you just sweep it under the rug? Do you face it?
Oh, it's complicated because I had different motives all the time that came to light as to how I wanted to approach the film. Of course, it's about someone who's dead and how you deal with that trauma. But I also was interested in how you can become complicit in the silence also as a victim. And I thought it was brave, by the way, when like the Me Too movement, I found it so fascinating. I thought people are just saying things out loud. That's incredible, right? Because at least in my family, and each family, you have the overall Zambian culture, you have Bemba culture, which is my tribe, but you also have a culture within certain families, you know, that are upheld, as we can all maybe relate to. And it's also really complicated because a lot of people also talk around women and their silence. Why didn't she say something, you know? Mm-hmm. Especially when women are like vocal in real life, you can find strong, vocal, independent women who are still not able to speak about certain things. It makes it complicated because you're not only dealing with trauma, you're also dealing with shame. And it's the shame around it that keeps the silence. So I was interested in exploring that in the opposite of that, the opposite of what I was seeing. And I wanted to show it how it reflects in our society and why it's difficult to speak up, but why it's still important to speak up, no matter how difficult it is, even though it feels like nothing can change.
I was fascinated watching the funeral traditions. It felt like such a significant part of the movie, just seeing people on their knees walking into the house, the apologies, the way you're supposed to apologize. And I felt very connected to it, even though it's not my culture, because I feel like a lot of that happens around funerals, even though the actual traditions may be different.
I mean, I think at some of the Q&As, people would ask me, you know, does that really happen? And I'm sitting there thinking, actually, yeah, it does really happen. And also there's the equivalent of what happens here. You just are not making that connection. So I'm really happy to hear that you have made these connections between the two, whereas something that someone might look at, you know, tie it down to being Zambian culture, but actually there's something that correlates to that that happens when we go to funerals in England or, you know, in America. Those scenes for me, being a part of them, was just such... it was so spiritual and just incredibly moving, which obviously helped for my performance. Just the voices, and there's so much going on. The reality of being at these funerals, when you are someone of Shula's age who's at these funerals, there's so much going on for you that you've got to juggle between being dutiful and being there. You're catching up with your friends and you're doing this. But along all these things that Shula's kind of doing and being a part of, serving the uncles and orchestrating all of this, she's got this thing that's kind of festering inside of her that's just sitting there that she's not really being allowed or given the time to deal with. So she's operating whilst carrying this thing. So yeah, it was really nice to be able to focus on certain things specifically within the activity around the funeral and focus on that and then move on to something else. And I actually learned a lot about my own tradition whilst filming these.
Can you talk about the dynamic, Rungano, between the elder women and the younger women in this? Because you have the older women who have made choices and say they're defending the younger generation, but then you have the younger generation that's pushing back.
Yeah, this is also the fascinating thing about our culture, because one of the things was discussed during the development process, and I hear this a lot because I write other films and usually women leads, and the thing that people like to discuss, and I think it's a concept that's true to Britain, is about your character doesn't have agency, because they don't see that, right? Because she's not speaking up, so therefore she doesn't have agency. I said, no, but it's shown in a different way, because we are a collective society. We're not a society of individuals. I fundamentally really believe this. I think our mothers are trying to prepare us for a reality that we just don't want to even engage in. So in reality, women do get attacked. Women don't get believed. Women get scapegoated. And there's nothing you can do to avoid that. Yeah. But then I think the message is you still shouldn't allow that to make you quiet, I guess. And then the younger generation are always just trying to change the rules, right? So the older ones are trying to live within the rules that society, and then the younger ones are trying to change the rules. And that's where they sort of, butt heads.
The name of the film, On Becoming a Guinea Fowl. And in the movie, we learn that guinea fowl, they're supposed to alert the rest of the savannah to when danger arises. And part of this film is about, I guess, who's going to speak up, who's going to alert. And the danger was Uncle Fred. He's dead now, but there's still danger, right? Because all of this pain is within.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's very good.
Beautiful. Yeah.
I haven't heard it said so succinctly. It's been what I've been trying to explain for like 3 years.
Write it down. Quick, Rungani, write it down.
Susan will know. Every time I was trying to explain things, I'm like, I feel it's like, I don't know. It's like, you know, silence and like complicitness. And I used to talk around it, and you've just said it so perfectly.
Do you look at your work as a way of speaking out, helping to protect the rest of the world around you, or at least shine a light on it?
Yeah, I think it's for the world. I think essentially it's probably for me. Mm. I find it difficult to speak up. I still do. I'm still trying to find a balance. I'm still learning. And I think it was born from that fascination of really finding other people being brave enough to do that. And I found that really, it was like an alien thing to me.
That's director Rungano Nyoni and actor Susan Shardy. Their film, On Becoming a Guinea Fowl, is in theaters now. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.